Evan Kleiman, and this is Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com. Erin Go Brath, celebrate St. Patrick's Day with a black and tan. What is a black and tan and how to pour one? Today on the show. I'll turn the tables on Jonathan Gold and critique his pesto. The top 10 new restaurants in L.A. But first, let's see what's in season at the Santa Monica Farmers Market this week. And Miss Edie Kleiman, my beautiful mom, celebrating her 90th birthday today. I'm dedicating this market report to you.
This is Laura Avery with the Market Report. We're welcoming back one of our favorite exotic fruits here to the farmers market on Wednesday. It's a wonderful subtropical fruit called cherimoya. People that grow avocados are capable of growing cherimoyas because of the climate and because of the conditions under which they grow. And we're visiting now with Elisa Hunsicker, and she's the cousin of a cherimoya farmer from Carpinteria. And first of all, Elisa, let's start by trying to describe what they look like and then making an attempt at describing how they taste.
Okay, someone this morning said that they look like almost like as if they're from the dinosaur era. They're just like a large melon. They have a combination of flavors, whether it's papaya, strawberry, pear. You can eat them like a melon. So you can scoop them out with a spoon or cut them in chunks. But you do not want to eat the skin or the seeds.
Only because they taste bad or because they're bad for you?
The seeds are toxic. They're bad for you.
Oh, okay. Well, the seeds are large, black, and smooth. They're kind of like small marbles. But the fruit itself, it looks kind of like you said, like a dinosaur egg. It's kind of like a giant cross between an avocado and an artichoke with sort of scales all over it. And they're all irregularly shaped, although I think they kind of stick to a pear-shaped motif. But they get to be like 3 pounds each.
I'll tell you, each tree will grow all four of these sizes, from a few ounces to 3 pounds, and depending on the size of the blossom.
Oh, I see. And then tell us, that's so interesting, how are they pollinated?
Well, in South America, where they're from, they're pollinated by a very, very small beetle, about the size of a pinpoint. But here in Southern California, we have to pollinate them by hand. We use a paintbrush, and the bloom is hermaphroditic, so in the morning it's a female, and in the afternoon it's a male. And so in the afternoon you collect the pollen with the paintbrush into a little container, and then in the morning you take your paintbrush, dip it in the container with the pollen, and then actually physically insert it into the female bloom.
That is amazing. And how do you eat them? How do you know when they're ready, and then how do you eat them other than just scoop them out with a spoon?
Well, we know when they're ready because right off the tree they're a very uniform pale green. But as they ripen, the skin turns to a brownish green. So it'll have the same feel as a ripe avocado, and the skin will be kind of brownish green. You can eat them like a melon. You can cube them and put them in a seafood salad with a little lime, cilantro, and chili if you like. You can make them in a daiquiri. You can make a sorbet. You can make an ice cream. I'm even thinking of a pastry cream. And they last about like a day or two, like pears. When they're ready to eat, they're ready to eat. And they, you need to eat it all at that time in one serving.
And the season is going to be, we're now, what, early March? It'll be March, I'll say mid-March through, what, end of May?
Yes, depending on the trees. We've had a really great crop this year. If we're lucky, it'll be mid-June, but probably June 1st.
All righty. Well, thank you, Elisa. It's great to have you here.
Thank you, Laura.
That was Elisa Hunsicker, and she's selling these wonderful, weird-shaped cherimoyas. They're delicious. They have a white flesh. They can be eaten in a number of ways. They'll be here at the market through the end of May. We're talking with Zoe Nathan, who, of course, is the wonderful pastry chef, co-owner of Huckleberry here in Santa Monica. And she and her husband, Josh Loeb, are also owners of Rustic Canyon. And Zoe and Josh, you guys are going to be starting with a Thursday night family-style dinner at Huckleberry. This is so exciting because Huckleberry is mainly known for your fabulous pastry.
I mean, our whole idea is we wanted to make what we make at home when we go home. We'll have just one set menu. You'll sit down and you'll eat exactly what we'll be eating that night also. It all stemmed from the fact that I had this idea that I wanted to know exactly what you were ordering for dessert right when you sat down so we could fire it right then. So, you know, if the cake takes 45 minutes to bake, then we're baking it fresh, you know. And if we're going to have a crostata, it's going to be fresh and hot out of the oven because, you know, I'm a baker, and I in the morning, there's nothing better.
So give us a recipe idea for what you're going to be making, maybe for your out-of-the-oven dessert.
Probably, for sure, our first one will be strawberry crostatas. We make them at the bakery all the time, but nobody ever gets them hot and fresh with fresh whipped cream that we'll make, you know, from Rustic and bring over and have it melting on top and warm and gooey.
And what is a crostata exactly?
A crostata is just a free-form tart. All we take is a pie dough and wrap it around whatever fruit we're finding at the market, put a healthy amount of butter, some salt, and some sugar, and then stick it in the oven, and that's it.
Okay, so you don't have to bake the crust first, you put it all in together, so it's super simple.
Super simple.
Yeah. And you're picking strawberries now, is that probably what you like best for the season?
Yeah, I mean, I love a strawberry crostata, personally. but yeah, that's definitely probably what we'll start with.
Okay, do you have to add anything to the fruit to make it taste even better?
It depends, but yeah, we usually either add brown sugar and white, a little bit of white sugar, and salt, and butter. Butter and salt, to me, always is all you need, usually.
Now, when are these family dinners going to start?
We're having our first one on the 25th.
All right. Well, thanks so much.
Bye.
That was Zoe Nathan and Josh Loeb, and they're, of course, the wonderful, proud co-owners of both Huckleberry and Rustic Canyon. That was Zoe telling us that Huckleberry is now going to start with a Thursday night family-style dinner starting this month on March 25th. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
Pictures and recipes from the Market Report are at kcrw.com/goodfood. Last week, Hollywood's biggest celebrities gathered at the Kodak Theater for the Academy Awards, the Oscars, of course. After everyone said their thank yous and finished their speeches, they all headed upstairs to the Governor's Ball and a big spread prepared by Wolfgang Puck. Good Food producer Harriet Ells caught up with the legendary chef before the big night.
When people come out after the ceremony, the good thing is everybody is really hungry. So we're going to start. When people walk in, they're going to see a big seafood buffet, like for little appetizers, lobsters and stone crabs and shrimps with remoulade sauce and stuff like that. Then we have 5 sushi chefs making little pieces of sushi. Plus, we pass around a lot of our little appetizers, like vegetable spring rolls, like mini crab cakes. We have our small hamburgers. We have our spicy tuna cones, and the list goes on and on. Once people sit down in the ballroom after for dinner, we'll serve them a crispy potato galette with dill cream, our own smoked salmon with a few baby greens and a little caviar. And then for main course, we have a black truffle chicken pot pie, which is like a twist on the old-fashioned chicken pot pie. So it's like comfort food, but made up very elegant. And then for dessert, we have individual baked Alaskas with chocolate sorbet and espresso ice cream inside and a toasted hazelnut meringue. And then we also make chocolate Oscars for everybody. The chocolate Oscars are covered in 24-karat gold, so everybody can take one or two of them home. To serve all that, we need like 300 chefs in the kitchen, and we have about 650 people in the dining room, like waiters, busboys, bartenders, maitres, everything.
Are there any classic dishes that people expect to see each year?
Well, every year we make a few things which are really classic, like our gold-covered chocolate Oscars. You know, we do that since we started. We make our little smoked salmon Oscars with caviar. We make that every year. And probably our mini Kobe burger, people really like them. So a few of these things we make every year. And then the main menu is different every year.
Do you have to take into account what they're wearing when designing your dishes?
You know, everybody's really hungry at the end of the show. So no matter what dress they have on, it might have stretched already a little bit while they were sitting in the theater. Everybody is really hungry. And since most of the, especially women, you know, by the time they get makeup, the hairdresser, the manicure, and all that things together, they might have had a toast and some tea at 8 in the morning. They probably didn't have lunch because they had to be here by 4 o'clock. And then I think comes 10 o'clock at night, they're really hungry. So nobody thinks about calories. Nobody thinks, oh, I don't want to eat this or that. Everybody wants great food.
They all are actually eating.
Everybody is eating. And I remember like even people like Barbara Streisand asking for seconds, or Danny DeVito ask for seconds. So we have a lot of people who are so hungry, and they said, let's eat it because it tastes good. So they like it.
Do you ever get nervous serving a room full of Hollywood's biggest celebrities?
You know, most of the celebrities come to our restaurant already, so I know most of them, if it's George Clooney or Brad Pitt or Sidney Poitier or whoever they might be. You know, I know them very well, and so I'm not nervous about them. I'm more nervous that we serve them on time and that it's exactly the way I want it to be, because I don't want to cook anything ahead of time, and so we're going to bake like the black truffle chicken pot pie like at the last moment, but it has to be baked enough so it's really hot in it. The same thing with the potato galette. It has to be done the last moment.
Wolfgang Puck and his team served over 1,500 people that night. Pictures of some of the dishes, including the gold-covered chocolate Oscars, are at kcrw.com/goodfood. Tuesday is St. Patrick's Day. It's time to wear green and drink Guinness. But sometimes when I go to a pub, I have to say I order a black and tan. What is it and how to pour one at home? That's next. I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food. If you're celebrating St. Patrick's Day, you're probably drinking beer. Maybe even it's green. But maybe, just maybe, it's a black and tan. Where did the name come from? Do they really drink it in Ireland? And how do we pour one at home? John Marchini grew up in Ireland, and he's here to answer these questions. What is a black and tan?
Well, black and tan is a mixture of either ale or lager, but it's usually ale and Guinness. The ale, and in Ireland it would be like something like Smithwick's or Bass, and the Guinness on top.
And so it looks sort of like a beer pousse café. There's a definite separation between the two colors.
Yeah, there is a separation, although some people would drink them together. Traditionally, it is a separation.
Where does the name Black and Tan come from?
Well, the Black and Tans were an auxiliary police force in the... During the Civil War in Ireland, around the 1910s, or 1910s, 1920s, I guess that was the way they dressed. It was like, it wasn't a full uniform, but they had light pants, dark top.
And they were sent into Ireland by the British?
Yeah, they were indeed.
So does that mean that there's a political component to ordering a black and tan in Ireland?
Well, I'm from Northern Ireland, and funnily enough, there's no problem whatsoever of ordering black and tans in the north. Although in the Republic of Ireland, there would be more, like they suffered more under the black and tans than they did in the north.
I understand that there's a song. Could you sing some of it for us?
Oh, man. All I remember is just one line, which was, "The black and tans like lightning ran from the rifles of the IRA." That's the only line I remember of that.
Wow. So, if we were visiting Belfast, would it still be taboo to order a black and tan?
Belfast, I'm sure you'll get away with it okay.
Okay, so I imagine that the trick to keeping the two brews separate is in the pour.
It is, and it's in what you put in first. You would put in the Smithwick's or Bass first, the ale, and then top it up with the Guinness. And to do that, use some like this really complicated piece of machinery called the spoon. Which you turn upside down and just pour the Guinness over it, and it kind of slows it down. Although many times people just want it mixed. They don't care whether it's on top. But yeah, you would use a spoon just to pour it on and settle it there.
I really love when it's not mixed because I have the choice. I can start drinking it, and when you drink it when it's not mixed, you get mostly the bottom comes into your mouth first with just a little hint of that really great sort of chocolate coffee of the Guinness.
Right.
And then, you know, after a while, you can just stir it up and drink the whole thing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, you could always do it two or three times, and for the third time, you probably won't care anyway.
So what's the Guinness like in Ireland to drink? I know it must taste different than it tastes here.
It does taste different. It's smoother. A lot of times, Guinness over here is... you do have a bit more bitterness. Although, I don't know why, but there's certain bars that do have really smooth Guinness. Like they say in Dublin, it never travels further than a block away. That's about as far away from the brewery that you can drink it. But I think you can actually go a bit further than that.
Thank you so much, John.
You're very welcome. Thank you, Evan.
John Marchini was raised in Northern Ireland and currently lives in upstate New York. I've got a video demonstrating how to pour a black and tan from beer experts, the Hot Knives, Alex Brown and Evan George. Check it out at kcrw.com/goodfood. What are you drinking this St. Paddy's Day? Tell me your traditions by leaving a comment on today's show at kcrw.com/goodfood. Last week, I talked with Eddie Lynn about another type of green food, lime jello. The dish we talked about is called Pacific Lime Mold. Oh, and many listeners chimed in to tell me that it's actually quite delicious, despite its horrific appearance. I'm convinced I'll have to try it sometime. Check out some of the comments on last week's show at kcrw.com/goodfood. And now on to another green food, and this is a total coincidence, I promise, pesto. A couple of weeks ago, a friend of mine in Italy asked me to judge a pesto competition at Vicente, a restaurant in Brentwood here in L.A. It was the Los Angeles semifinals of the International Pesto Competition, which takes place in Genoa every year. To my great surprise and delight, Jonathan Gold was not a fellow judge, but a contestant. Ooh, a chance to judge Jonathan. How wonderful. Of course, Jonathan is the Pulitzer Prize-winning food critic for the LA Weekly, and he joins me now here in the studio to tell us about the experience.
It was a very, very even playing field. We weren't allowed to bring our own ingredients, our own mortar, so we had giant bushes of basil, very, very, very sort of like overgrown basil, but basil nonetheless. Pine nuts from Liguria, you know, olive oil.
But no, the pine nuts were from China.
They looked like the tiny Chinese ones, but they were in Italian packaging.
I asked the big cheese of the event, and he said they were from China.
Oh, that's interesting. Again, it was in packaging suggesting it was from Liguria. There were paper cups of browned Parmigiano Reggiano and Pecorino Sardo. There was a little salt, no pepper, which is a problem because pepper is such a key to a good pesto, I think.
I mean, I think so, but apparently it's not the classic. Describe a little bit the pecorino sardo, because that was a surprise for some of the people, the aggressive nature of that cheese.
Pecorino sardo is a sheep cheese from Sardinia, as the name suggests. And the one they used was especially, it was soft and it was very, very pungent. I use sardo 50-50 with the Parmigiano when I'm making pesto at home, but it's usually drier. It was completely level playing field, by the way. And you had people who were in chefs, and you had people who were in the restaurant business, and you had people who had never actually made pesto before. And they were all using the same ingredients. And they were all using these sort of beautiful small marble mortars. And theoretically, anybody could have come up with the best pesto.
And it was interesting for me because the program that you have to follow for judging is very specific. So I was taken on the side earlier and told what I had to look for. And the things I had to look for were how finely the basil had been beaten into submission, that it shouldn't be spinach-like, obviously. It should be really, really small pieces. The color of the pesto, it should be a nice green, but it shouldn't have been allowed to oxidize to start to get too dark. Conversely, it shouldn't be too light because that belies the addition of too much oil or too much cheese. The texture of the overall pesto was a big factor, whether it was creamy. It had that beautiful creaminess. And of course, balance of flavor, the most important thing. And it was really interesting because there were how many contestants? 12?
12.
As we approached each mortar, it was obvious that there was going to be quite a large range of success. And there was only one that was completely inedible because the amount of garlic was just totally overpowering. But I think the biggest problem that most people had was their unfamiliarity with the mortar and pestle. There was a lot of spinach, a lot of spinach sauce.
I make a lot of pesto at home, and I will admit sometimes I use fiddles. I have been known to use the blender, in fact, at least half the time. And the other fiddle that I do is I think it's often like a good tasting sauce when you do the garlic and the pine nuts in the submission and then just chop the basil and mix it in. So it's like sort of an herb thing rather than
a paste.
I think everybody approached it slightly differently. You know, I tried to get the smallest and tenderest leaves from the armful of basil. I used actually less garlic than I usually do because I know that the Italian taste is to use probably half as much as we tend to use. I know that the traditional way is actually to put the pine nuts in with the garlic, so that is a paste, instead of putting it at the end to have like a slightly pleasant, nutty, gritty texture at the end. You're looking for the creamy thing. You put that in there and you put the basil in there, you know, putting the salt, coarse salt at various intervals so it will act as, you know, tiny little millstones helping you do your work. And then you pound and you pound some more and you pound some more and your arm feels like it's going to fall off. You feel like there's got to be some muscular John Henry of pesto somewhere in the universe that's just going to bash that mortar right through the table.
It was really interesting because as we were watching, we also had to judge on cleanliness and technique, the comfort with which people approach the mortar. And there were some people there who obviously had done it over and over and over again and had a very good technique, the way they were moving that pestle through their material. And there were others who obviously had never used a mortar and pestle before.
Yeah, there is a definite, I wouldn't say rhythm to it, but you're supposed to pound the basil leaves until most of the liquid is exuded. At that point, your pound goes to more of a grinding motion. And there were a lot of people there that didn't sort of make that transition from the pound to the grind, or who started out grinding, or who were imitating some jackhammer they'd seen breaking up asphalt somewhere in Culver City.
It was really, really an enjoyable evening.
I know where I was undone.
Where were you undone?
I believe I was undone by the pungency of the Pecorino, because I'd worked with what I thought was the same product before, and I tasted it, but it didn't quite register like its absolute strength. I put in just a couple of pinches because I didn't want to overwhelm it, but the couple of pinches did, in fact, overwhelm it, at which point I was 25 minutes into my 30 minutes of pounding, and I put in a couple more handfuls of basil in order to sort of even it out, and then it probably didn't work. I panicked, Evan. I panicked.
It was so great to see you amongst all these people pounding and then being nervous with your mortar and pestle. But the cheese undid quite a few people. I'd say that the ability to balance a dish that's made out of such pretty aggressive flavors isn't easy. And I think you have to, the people who added tiny bits at a time of things did the best. Although I have to say that the one I liked the best, which had the creamiest texture, was said to be too oily by the Italian chef experts. So we compromised. And a woman who apparently lives just down the street from Vicente, an artist named Andrea, won. She's going to be winging off to Genoa for the World Pesto Competition. I have to say it was really fun. It was an unusual situation to be in with you and one that turned out to be great.
It was a great evening.
Find a pesto recipe at kcrw.com/goodfood. Coming right up, the top 10 new restaurants in LA. Stay tuned. This is Good Food.
Thank you.
I'm Evan Kleinman, and you're listening to Good Food. My restaurant, Angeli, is celebrating its 25th year. That's pretty impressive, considering the number of new restaurants that open in this town every year. Today, Patrick Q, restaurant critic from Los Angeles Magazine, joins me to discuss the top 10 best new restaurants in L.A.
Number 10 is Westside Tavern. In the Westside Pavilion, Chef Warren Schwartz, with a really fantastic resume, Patina, South Peak Lodge, Whist in Santa Monica, and he goes high volume in a mall under the Cineplex. Your expectations are, not great when you're theoretically presented with that, and yet he nails dish after dish, gets that big city barroom vibe, hundreds of people eating at the same time, everybody satisfied, everybody happy. Before movie or after movie or even as a destination, Westside Tavern is a great little place.
Okay, now let's go to number 9.
Eva, Mark Gold's restaurant, tiny little restaurant. He's out in the dining room. I'm a little wary of chefs constantly out in the dining room, but he does it so well that he adds so much to the restaurant that I think it's a real plus. And, he'll make an egg cream for kids. He'll be really kind and thoughtful to older people who've wandered in. His food has this kind of bistro directness.
And what did you eat there that you particularly liked?
Well, I liked the Sunday supper, which is a three-course affair. He does like a great chicken tagine, a great pot roast, a wonderful salad with hand-torn croutons. There's just that sense of conviviality and joy, which is so important to restaurants.
Okay, now number eight.
Number 8 is Bar Bricks. A wine bar, Bricks, is kind of this magical evocation of the sugar degree that wine is picked at. So the moment you see Bricks with an X, there's something wine about it. And Don Dickman, he used to be at Rocca here in Santa Monica. He sort of panned back, and now he encompasses the whole Mediterranean. It really fits into the Silver Lake neighborhood. It's accessible, it's unpretentious, and it's really focused and fantastic cooking with a great, great wine list.
Bottega Louie.
Bottega Louie is this huge place downtown. It occupies the whole ground floor of a massive old building. It's just a hub of so many things. It's a point of reference in so many people's daily lives downtown. It's breakfast. It's the 11:30 little snack. It's lunch. It's an early supper before a show. It's something after a Lakers game. It's frat parties of USC kids. It's everything under one roof with kind of an evocation of old line Italian food, but done. Chef Sam Marvin has worked around, and he kind of lightens it up just where he needs to, brings just enough produce to it to without making it precious, and it's contemporary and yet it's evocative.
Tavern Suzanne Goen.
Tavern Suzanne Goen and Caroline Stein in a spot previously occupied by a Hamburger Hamlet in Brentwood. I think the space has given them a wonderful opportunity to try out things that they've always, like, I suspect, had on their to-do list. Like, what would it be like to have an all-day kind of drop-in spot? And what would it be like to have, at the same time, a really great, luxurious dining room? Why should the two cancel each other out? The front part, called the larder, it really does have tables of people, like, after jogging on San Vicente, discussing their screenplay, you know, the perennial scene of L.A., people saying, well, what would be my character's motivation? As they're having fantastic sandwiches, she does a turkey sandwich with cranberry sauce and stuffing. It almost sounds unwieldy between two slices of bread, but it's really a fantastic sandwich.
And now one of the most eagerly awaited arrivals, Thomas Keller's Bouchon.
Thomas Keller's Bouchon, I think it goes to prove that when talent and passion are there, it can make up for an awful lot. Because, I mean, to be honest, it's in a brand new development in Beverly Hills on the second floor. You really have to nail it to make people want to go to that. It's pleasant. It's nice. There's a garden outside. But still, you're on the second floor of a brand new development. And he does it.
So now we move to number 4 and Mochica.
Mochica, again, a very curious spot. It's in Mercado La Paloma, which is south of downtown. It's a market that was built by a community group to give local people a stake in the community to earn some money, to have, there's a seamstress, there's a notary, there's and there's Mochica, a restaurant that does that curious thing of completely capturing two cultures simultaneously. On the one hand, it's Peruvian, that cuisine of grain and of braises and of corn and of fermented corn drinks, and the Japanese aesthetic, which Ricardo Sarate is really accomplished at. He is a sushi chef. He's a chef at Wabi Sabi in Venice. And, of course, there's a long tradition of Japanese and Peruvian cultures coming together. Nobu Matsuhisa, brought it here. But where Matsuhisa says Japanese inflected by Peruvian, Sarate is Peruvian through the prism of Japanese delicacy.
Beautiful. Wow. Interesting. And then number three, Drago Centro.
Yeah. I love it. And I love the way you pronounce it too. it's just that big, high-ceilinged restaurant downtown with huge windows, huge displays of flour, and the food of Celestino Drago completely nuanced, completely articulates an Italian approach to food so wonderfully. Little sweetbread agnolotti with a veal broth, but a homemade veal broth where it's just golden brown and it's bathing the pasta, and it's just heartwarming, really, kind of dish. LA, downtown LA particularly, needs this great urbane kind of place that could be in Milan, you know, and it's wonderful.
Number two, Bistro LQ.
Well, Laurent Coigneux has a long history in LA. He's a French chef who's completely open to the wonders that LA provides. I mean, this is a French chef who uses masa as one of his primary ingredients, you know? I mean, masa being the building block of tortillas and tamales. Like, he'll do a little masa saucer, sope, and he'll have braised boar with a wonderfully braised sauce. And, you know, boar for the French, sanglier, it's like, oh, that's deep France. That's going back into the mists of, you know, to Clovis, king of the Franks. So there's this incredible juxtaposition of a really achieved French sensibility and a real openness to this city and everything that this city offers by inspiration.
That's lovely. And now number one, Rivera, John Sedler.
John Rivera Sedler, a chef, again, with a storied history in L.A. I think he's put a lot of the aspects of the modern restaurant into one magnificent creation. There's a great bar, hand-mixed tequila. He's a tequila expert. And the food is, what I love about it is it's opinionated. It's opinionated food. This is me, and this is what I care about. What speaks to him is the dialogue that Spain and the Americas have had for centuries. And he mines that in every possible facet.
Wow, this is such a great list, and I'm sure it's going to inspire a lot of people to go out and eat at places that they haven't yet tried. Thank you so much, Patrick.
Thank you, Evan. Pleasure.
Patrick Q is the restaurant critic for Los Angeles Magazine. Find his top 10 list at kcrw.com/goodfood. Is there a spot that you think should be on that list? Tell us by leaving a comment on today's show. You can do that at kcrw.com/goodfood. One thing I know quite well after hosting this show for so many years is that people feel very passionate about their favorite restaurant. You can quadruple that level of passion when it comes to talking about tacos. KCRW's own Matt Holtzman, producer of The Business, entered the hornet's nest of LA taco opinion when he picked his five favorite taco joints in the city.
Well, let me just first say that I didn't have to choose five tacos. And I did because I love tacos. Not because I'm an expert at tacos, but because I love them. But I've learned something very important. And that is, there are things that polite people don't talk about. Religion, money, sex, and politics. And now I'm adding tacos to that list because I had no idea that I was stepping into such a culinary minefield. I mean, the reaction.
Oh, my God. It is like the hornet's nest of people's opinions.
So why didn't you warn me? My sister called me. My lovely sister Stephanie called me, and she said, "What do you know about tacos?" And I just want to—I want to just read. May I?
Yes, please.
It says my five favorite tacos, and it starts by saying I'm not a food connoisseur, but I know the tacos that I like, and here they are. When you do something like this that you know is kind of for public consumption, I try to have a little bit of fun with it. But clearly, nobody has got a sense of humor about tacos. And and when we were talking about favorite tacos, just one of them was the Jack in the Box taco. And to me, the Jack in the Box taco is not just a taco. It's filled with history and memories of my youth, of drunken nights in college, of literally only having 99 cents to eat something. And they were 99 cents often for two. So in a way, they were a favorite. But are, you know, are they the greatest taco ever? Who would think, who would possibly think that I was making that argument? I don't even know what's in them.
It's a personal choice.
Absolutely. And I have to also say that one of the, if there was any comment that really surprised me the most was this sense of like, you better get out more. And when you look at the list of five tacos, one is in Alameda, which is down the Alameda corridor. One is in my neighborhood of Koreatown. You know, Jack in the Box, obviously all over the place. Cactus is on Vine in Hollywood. And Kogi is a truck. So could you be more geographically diverse than that?
Tell us, give us the list.
Okay,
the list, 1 to 5.
Well, the Alameda Swap Meet is at 44th and Alameda, southeast of downtown. And it is a huge, basically indoor swap meet. Like there are all over the hood, you know, throughout Southern California. But food is a huge part of what they have there. And there's all sorts of foods. But there's one particular main place that has every kind of taco you could possibly imagine, from internal organs that I didn't even know cattle had, to potatoes, to deep fried, to whatever. So in terms of just an opportunity to explore different kinds of tacos and sauces and everything else, it's just incredible. And they're very inexpensive. And the atmosphere there is so kind of festive that it's just a fun place to go. So that is one of my favorites.
And what do you order when you go there?
I have tried almost everything there. I'm not a huge fan of the organ meats or like lengua, the tongue or cabeza or any of that kind of stuff. So I, honestly, at the end of the day, I'm a carnitas man. I mean, I love pork. And they also have a potato taco that is incredibly, incredibly good. And then they have a variety of salsas. And I couldn't tell you what I was eating. I know I just, you know. And they also have a huge selection of agua frescas, you know, these fruit drinks that are beautiful to look at. And especially when you've just had a greasy hot taco, it just, you know, sandia, watermelon or, you know, whatever is so refreshing afterwards. And they fry fresh churros there. So they're just making them right there. The food, the health department, I think every once in a while makes them stop because it's dangerous. It's just a big open vat of oil. But I mean, it's just a complete meal. So it's really not even the taco. It's the entire experience.
Okay. Your next pick.
The next is, yes, not very inventive. I know I'm not on the leading edge of the culinary experience.
You don't have to be defensive.
The Kogi taco, the Korean taco truck.
I love the Kogi taco.
I mean, it's a delicious, delicious thing. And it used to actually come here to Santa Monica College where KCRW is. And it was the highlight of my afternoon to go get one of those salty, sweet, little delicious items. Three is Cactus, which is just a taco stand that are all over. And, you know, the taco stand is a very Southern California thing. And I'm just very comfortable there. And I just happen to love their fish tacos, their fried fish and their fried shrimp tacos and the white stuff that goes on top, the unnamed white stuff and the cabbage. They're also very hot for some reason. There's something spicy in them that is unidentifiable and quite painful. Enjoyably painful. The Jack in the Box, as we've already discussed, which is, again, like a McDonald's burger is not a burger. A Jack in the Box taco is not a taco, but it's delicious in its own right.
See, it's so funny because one of my primary childhood memories of eating in Echo Park was there used to be a Foster's Freeze there, and I would go get their tacos, and it was like orange cheese wrapped in orange paper, super, super greasy. I would unwrap it. It was like mana to my childhood palate.
Que rico.
Que rico.
Yeah. And again, I mean, it is what it is. It is a thing unto itself that
And particularly to you that you embrace.
Right. And I am not the only one, I have to say, that I've had a lot of people, of all the things on this list, you know, people came up to me and said, oh, I forgot about those Jack in the Box tacos. And I literally do have coupons that I've had for 20 years, the 2 for 99. I think they're still good. And I will use them one day.
Okay, and the last.
The last one is actually kind of sad because since I wrote this, he's disappeared. I live near Western and Olympic in Koreatown. And on Olympic between Oxford and San Marino, there was a guy who was always there who had a little cart. And at night, you know, with the one light bulb hanging up and a little generator. And he was the sweetest man in the world, did not speak a word of English, and my Spanish is really poor. But we really had a nice time just sitting there trying to communicate, and he would make whatever meat he had brought that day. Sometimes it was unidentifiable to me. And he grilled these little chipoline onions on the side, and if you're a regular customer, he would give you a couple of those. And he just really enjoyed having me there and feeding me. You could see it was really a pleasure for him. And it was a great – outdoors, and it was my neighborhood and everything about it. And I honestly, they were different. I can't tell you how they were different. I don't think – he was from a region that I clearly was not familiar with because the tacos did taste a little different, at least the way that they were spiced. But he's gone now. Something – I don't know what happened shortly
health
after.
Health department got to him.
I don't think so because he had moved around quite a bit, and I know they had visited him before. There was some development going on in that corner, and I think the people who were doing the development actually shooed him away ultimately.
Aww.
And I hope I find him sometime because talk about a taco as – culture and experience. The tacos were great, but just hanging out with him was something. Sometimes when I'd come home from work late, it was just nice to be able to stop there and chat with him.
How fun to get to listen to you talk about food. We have to do this again.
I would love to.
Matt's five favorite tacos are on the KCRW blog, Five Things. You can find it at kcrw.com/5things. Tacos are cheap, but they're not free. Mari Silva would know. She's a college student who's made it her mission to find free food. Today, she shares the many deals she's found online.
February just marked my favorite day of the year, Free Pancake Day at IHOP, and I found out about it via Facebook. You make a small contribution to the Children's Miracle Network Foundation, and you get a free short stack. So I went to the IHOP in Hollywood off of Sunset, and guess who flipped my pancakes for me?
Who?
Miss America.
You're kidding me.
In full sash and crown.
On top of a chef coat or a sequined gown?
A sequined gown. She had a little apron on, but yeah, she flipped my pancakes.
And did you feel pressure to order something else besides the short stack?
No, I mean, I felt that that was enough. I didn't want to overeat or anything. And actually, earlier on in the day was a Jack-in-the-Box promotion where if you buy a free large drink, you get a free sandwich. So I didn't want to overextend my stomach.
Now, a free sandwich at Jack-in-the-Box, what did you choose?
I chose the Turkey Bacon Club, which was quite delicious. I would definitely have it again.
So since it's already not February, we're going to have to wait till next February for the next IHOP promotion. But they do this every year?
Every year. I've been going since high school.
It's really incredible. That's a great idea.
And I found out about this all via Facebook. Restaurants are taking to the internet and advertising their promotions. Like Denny just had a free Grand Slam day. The lines were quite long, but it was worth it because it's very delicious. Hidden LA has a food page where they were doing a promotion through February where if you, you know, tell the Bluebird Cafe that you were a fan of Hidden LA, you would get a free cupcake. And Twitter is also doing these promotions. The grilled cheese food truck sometimes has a promotion where if you say cheese or, you know, grilled cheese sandwich, you get a free shot of soup or free tater tots. So it's quite remarkable how, you know, restaurants are utilizing the web.
Incredible. What else do you have there for us?
Well, for people who aren't so web savvy or who don't have computers, you can do it old school, which I would always do with my mom when I was younger. You can go through the Sunday paper and cut coupons. You can sign up for birthday clubs at Denny's or Cafe 50s, where on your birthday they send you a certificate for a free meal or, you know, money off of your order. Also, if you have children or if you're babysitting, there's, you know, kids eat free night at IHOP or Denny's or other chain restaurants. And also, if you have a business card, you could put it in a raffle. And, you know, every week or so, restaurants will pick out your business card and give you a free meal or a free week of pizza and whatnot. Also, signing up for a Del Taco newsletter, they send you free coupons in the mail. So there's all sorts of things that you can do.
Thank you so much, Mari.
Oh, thank you, Evan.
Mari Silva is a college student and a volunteer at KCRW. Some of her free food recommendations are at kcrw.com/goodfood. If you have any ideas on how Mari can eat for free, let us know by leaving a comment on today's show. Up next, baking with whole grains. I'm Evan Kleiman, and I'll be right back. Whole grain muffins. Perhaps they bring to mind leaden lumps of should instead of tender crumbs of deliciousness. Well, get ready for Kim Boyce, because she's about to create a revolution in your kitchen. If you don't know Kim, let me introduce her, because she has one of those culinary pedigrees that make you want to cook from her book without even opening it. Kim started her professional baking career with the legendary Sherry Yard at the original Spago back in the day. She then moved to Campanile just when Nancy Silverton was ready to let someone else take on the day-to-day duties of pastry chef. So we know by that pedigree that Kim is a perfectionist tinkerer, just like her mentors. And that's what whole grain baking has really needed to make a breakthrough into the home kitchen in a big way. When many of us try to bake with whole grains, the first thing we usually do is pick up a bag of whole wheat flour.
Mm-hmm.
And then the results by making a one-to-one substitution are usually horrendous.
Mm-hmm.
Was that your experience as well when you first started?
It was. I was baking absolutely terrible pastries at the beginning. And it was really finding that line of how much whole grain flour to how much all-purpose white flour I could use. And sometimes you can push it, and other times you really need that all-purpose flour to maintain the integrity of the pastries.
Was there one experience with flour that just completely surprised you more than any other, that you really found yourself turning to over and over again?
Yes. There were two that really surprised me. It was rye and teff flour. And rye was the one I saved it till the very end. I had sort of had this preconceived notion of rye flour being paired, you know, rye bread. That's what I thought of rye flour. And it is the easiest flour to use. I would highly recommend that one over whole wheat flour. If you were going to start with whole grain baking, it's a great place to start. It's sweet and mellow, and it really folds nicely into many recipes.
Give us an idea of what flavors you paired it with.
My favorite recipe that came out of the rye flour were the soft rye pretzels. And at first I was trying to use white flour, just all-purpose flour and whole wheat. And then I threw some rye flour in there, and I got the stretch that you get in a, you know, the nice chew that you get from a pretzel. And it lent a fuller, rounder, a little sour, you know, this really great flavor to the pretzels.
Okay, let's talk about teff for a minute.
Yes.
Teff, for people who eat Ethiopian food, mm-hmm. know that famously it's the grain of injera.
Correct.
That sort of strange, sour,
spongy
bread.
And that was all I knew it as. Teff flour came as a complete surprise. It appears like light cocoa. It's really milky tasting. And it was the one that came in and saved four of my recipes that I could not figure out. It is the tiniest grain, and so it's a really, really fine powder. And it came in, there was a muffin recipe that I was working with, a hazelnut muffin, and it was really oily, and I was trying to make it with this brown butter, and I think there's some cream in the recipe, and it was just oily, and it was kind of curd-like, the texture. It was not appealing. And I threw some teff flour in, just about a half a cup, three-quarters of a cup. And it was as though it absorbed the extra fat. It softened up the crumb. It was this beautiful, moist muffin.
Okay, now I want to ask you about gram flour. Mm-hmm. What exactly is gram flour?
Gram flour is a coarsely ground whole wheat flour. So it's just whole wheat flour, a little coarser.
And did you, in fact, use it to make graham crackers?
I did, of course. I couldn't resist. But it was the teff flour, along with the coarse graham, you know, the graham flour, that really made the graham crackers, you know, have this great snappy texture.
And you ended up developing a recipe for grape nut cereal.
I did.
Tell me how that came about.
I have a favorite cookbook. It's an Amish cookbook, and I've looked at it through the years, and I noticed a recipe in there for graham nuts, and that was a cereal I grew up eating, and I thought it would be fun to develop an actual graham nut recipe using graham flour.
Is it hard to do?
No, not at all. It's a simple batter stirred in a bowl, and then you spread it very, very thin on a sheet pan and bake it until it's crisp.
And then you just crumble it up?
Actually, I found grinding it through the cheese grater, the cheese attachment of the Cuisinart, worked best.
Kamut flour is something that's really interesting because it's this really large wheat. I know that when I really want to splurge and get really incredible dried pasta, I will buy kamut.
To make your own pasta with.
No. To like
prepare
rigatoni. Like I'll buy it already, you know, like a dried pasta.
Oh, delicious.
And it's the most al dente, most toothsome, incredible pasta. So what does kamut do in baked goods?
In baked goods, it sort of has a sandy texture to it. It, like you said, it has a really nice bite. It's very buttery. It's very yellow in color. And the color translates into its flavor. It lends a butteriness. So I found it worked best in shortbread cookies, in challah.
So the challah recipe, some purists might think, oh, I don't want to use this different kind of flour. Describe what the crumb of the finished challah is like.
It's very similar to a traditional challah made with white flour. It has the nice strands that pull apart. It's a little bit chewy. It has some structure to it. It's beautiful. And the yellow, along with the yellow of the egg yolks, makes for a really beautiful challah.
Wow. Wonderful. Thank you so much, Kim.
Thank you, Evan.
Kim Boyce's new book is Good to the Grain. Kim will be signing her book, and there'll be lots of little pastries made from the book later today at Little Flower Candy Company in Pasadena. We'll have a link to information about the signing and a recipe from the book at kcrw.com/goodfood. Hearty whole grains are emblematic of the food of Ireland. Think steel-cut oats. My next guest wrote a beautiful book about Irish country cooking. Coleman Andrews is an acclaimed food writer.
There's good news and bad news, and it's the same fact, which is that with the exception in this book of, I don't know, there's probably 12 or 15 recipes that you could qualify as fairly complicated, fairly complex, time-consuming. The rest of them are very, very simple. And that's good news because it means that they're easy to cook. It's bad news because it means if you're not using extraordinarily flavorful raw materials, then they're not going to taste like much. So you need to find really great stuff to work with. You need even not just the meat and dairy products and so forth, but if you make a soup of leek and oatmeal, those leeks had better be flavorful and not the kind of bland fibrous ones that it's too easy to buy in the supermarket.
Wow, a soup of leeks and oatmeal. What is that called?
It's called Brötchenfolchep, and it's actually one of the oldest recipes that is known in Ireland, arguably the oldest one. And oatmeal, of course, has been very important in the Irish diet. And oats are a crop that grow very well. And there's oat cakes, and there's oatmeal used in baking, and there's even herring that dredged in brochen or dredged in oatmeal and fried, which is a little hardcore. But this recipe for leek and oatmeal soup, which is nothing but oatmeal, leeks, chicken stock, and milk, and a little butter and seasoning, it can be dated back to about the 6th century, and it was the favorite soup of a saint and kind of literary icon, St. Columbkill. And so this is really ancient Irish food, which is kind of fun. And The soup making tradition, though, in general in Ireland, is that's one of the strengths of their cooking.
Well, we are coming up on St. Patrick's Day, so I suppose we do have to touch on a couple of things: corned beef and cabbage, and then Guinness. So let's talk about corned beef and cabbage. Often when immigrants come to a new country, they're traditional dishes become refracted in some way, and often not in a good way.
Right.
Is that the case with corned beef and cabbage?
Well, what I found out when I, you know, I, like everyone, I thought I knew the real secret, and I have been confidently telling people for years, oh, corned beef and cabbage is not real Irish food. It's Irish immigrant food, Irish American food. But I just don't think that's true. It turns out that although a more common, I would say the common dish for St. Patrick's Day and for any time when you're going to eat a big piece of meat is what the Irish would call bacon and cabbage. Bacon, though, you have to realize in Ireland means, first of all, it doesn't mean our kind of bacon, American bacon at all. It means back bacon, like which is more like what we'd call Canadian bacon, very lean. But it also, that term is also used to refer to any kind of cured pork, so unless it's ham. So when somebody says bacon and cabbage in Ireland, they mean a beautiful, big, lean pork loin, usually, that's it's been brined, and then you have to boil it for an hour or so to get the salt out, and then you bake it for a little while with a glaze. So that's it, more typical than corned beef and cabbage. But corned beef and cabbage, what I found out was that it's been eaten for hundreds of years in Ireland. And there's a wonderful woman called Brid Mahan, who's a folklorist. She wrote a book about food and more or less the folklore and history of food called The Land of Milk and Honey. And she said that although the fresh Irish beef has always been well-liked, that corned beef was equally popular, and that boiled and served with green cabbage and potatoes, it was a festive dish to be eaten at Halloween, Christmas, St. Patrick's Day, weddings and wakes, and that that tradition was brought to the New World by the immigrants in the 18th and 19th century. And what you often read is that, oh, when the Irish got here, they couldn't find the bacon for their bacon and cabbage, so they substituted corned beef. Well, I mean, that never made any sense to me, because if you think about it, the Irish went to exactly the same East Coast cities where they had lots of German and Eastern European immigrants already, who had all kinds of cured pork and all kinds of brined pork loins and things. They could have easily found that, probably more easily than corned beef.
Now, Guinness, you call it the wine of the country.
Right. It's the emblematic, the symbolic drink of Ireland. You know, there's kind of a cult about it, to the extent that serious Guinness drinkers, of whom there are a good many in Ireland, will go to one pub rather than another because the barman at this pub knows how to pull a proper pint of Guinness and the other one is a little too quick with it or something like that.
Coleman Andrews' new book is Irish Country Cooking. Find a recipe from the book at kcrw.com/goodfood. You know that you can podcast or download our show, find all past episodes, and information on all our guests at kcrw.com/goodfood. You can sign up for our weekly newsletter there, too. And, of course, follow me on Twitter. I'm Evan Kleiman. That's Kleiman. Good Food's executive producer is Jennifer Farrow. The show's produced and edited by Harriet Ells, with Bob Carlson, Candace Moyer, Holly Tarson, and Jillian Ferguson. Thanks to Darby Maloney. I leave you today with some Irish music from the Chieftains. It's a song called Boil the Breakfast Early.